Emily Johnston, May 21st, 2017. Guest sermon at Northlake Unitarian Universalist Church in Kirkland, Washington, titled, Withdrawing Consent from Catastrophe. The video is also posted on YouTube.
This is my first sermon, and I hope you'll forgive me if I ramble a little bit. I know that a good sermon requires a story, and preferably a personal story, and so I want to tell you a little bit about how I came to shut down pipelines. But I also, it feels really important for me to convey what I think that the world requires of all of us right now. So that's what I'm going to try to do. My neighbor and friend John is a minister, and I was telling him about doing this yesterday and saying basically I wasn't sure that I was up to the task. I'd never spoken in public for more than like 3 or 4 minutes, and 18 minutes seemed like a long time. And he said, you know, we preachers have a saying, God does not call the qualified, God qualifies the called. And I thought that was perfect actually as a metaphor for direct action. And to be totally clear, I'm not sure I believe in God, but I do believe in people being called to do certain things. And I don't think that we did this thing because we were brave. I think that we became brave by doing this thing. And that is the thing that I think is required of all of us. This part is probably obvious, but I wasn't born shutting off pipelines, and I wasn't an organizer for most of my life. I wasn't even an activist, except for a year or two in my early 20s. For decades, I held many jobs, but my primary identity was as a writer. And that's in part because, and of course, the two things feed each other, but I'm an introvert. I like, you know, small groups of people and quiet places. The sort of hustle and bustle of activism and is not my natural habitat, as somebody recently described it. In addition to being a writer, though, I'm a reader and a lover of nature. And when I could, I also loved to travel. And I biked through Europe and I walked all over Turkey. And basically, yeah, I think what combines all of those things is I just have a really deep appreciation for all of the, you know, human and non-human inhabitants and for the world and this incredibly beautiful place that we all share. I first read about climate change in 1989, thanks to Bill McKibben's The End of Nature. It would be an exaggeration to say that I never slept well after that, but it wouldn't be much of one. From childhood, I had been sort of acutely and strangely aware of illness in our nature, in our relationship with the broader world. I couldn't quite metabolize the fact that we were causing various animals to be wiped off the planet forever. I understood that all this stuff around me was made of plastic and that plastic didn't biodegrade, and I wondered like how it made any sense that this was what we were doing. And so, you know, reading The End of Nature really sort of brought all of this together for me, because it just in a really sick way made sense as a way of showing and describing that we were having impacts on the world that we were way beyond what we understood, and that we couldn't keep, you know, that our interaction with the world, something was fundamentally wrong with it. So, but like most people, I just went on living my life. You know, I was working for a living mostly as a waitress and bartender, and I was working on writing a novel. And every now and then my consciousness was punctuated by these scientific reports from Jim Hansen or another climate scientist filtered through the daily newspaper, and it would be really disturbing. But it was always couched in uncertainties, and despite that, they were increasingly alarmed, and so I was too. And then, you know, one of the first times I really, I think, understood that it was something facing us much more immediately than we might have thought, you know, was in 2003 with the series of heat waves in Europe that with thousands of people died. It really registered as deeply ominous, because it was one example of what I knew people had been telling us for a long time was coming. But, you know, still, I wasn't a politician, I wasn't a scientist, I wasn't a lawyer, I didn't really, you know, what could I do? But it got harder and harder to live with my worry and also with my own inaction. I felt paralyzed, but also disgusted with myself. I had worked for Now for a couple of years in my early 20s and had sort of briefly been an accidental activist by doing that. And we had won a really important local battle for the dignity of the maids who worked at one of the big hotels downtown. And then we had also won the fight against the appointment of Robert Bork to the Supreme Court. Meanwhile, we'd lost the last ditch effort at the ERA, and then also helped to organize the first really big gay rights march in DC. So I understood that people could have this kind of power, and so I really had no excuse for not doing anything. But I voted, gave money when I could, I signed lots of petitions, and I thought maybe it was okay to just lead a private life, and it seemed like a pretty normal thing. Everybody around me was doing it. And then in 2010, there was flooding in Pakistan, where my brother-in-law's family lives, and it killed thousands of people, and it destroyed nearly 2 million homes. And even 2 years later, hundreds of thousands of people were still displaced. And living in this country and trying to imagine what 2 million destroyed homes looked like, and I believe it was 20% of the country was underwater for a while, and hundreds of thousands of people displaced, I couldn't even fathom it. When in 2011, Jim Hansen said that if we allowed the building of Keystone XL and the full exploitation of the tar sands, it was going to be game over for the climate, that did it finally for me. And I couldn't just, I realized that no, actually, it wasn't okay to just live a private life. People were dying, and I knew it was only the beginning. So when McKibben and others called for civil disobedience at the White House, I decided to go. It was about a week beforehand, and I tried to get a friend of mine to go with me, and she, sort of hemmed and hawed, and she's like, I just don't think that's the way we're going to solve climate change. And I'm like, well, what else are you going to do next week that's going to have a better chance of helping to solve the problem of climate change? And so, it was heartening to be there amongst a lot of other people who were as worried as I was. And Hurricane Irene actually happened while I was in D.C. for the arrest action. And that just, really seemed to sort of underline everything that we were doing. And so I came back, and I knew I had to stay involved, but as far as I knew, nothing was going on around climate in Seattle. And it's true, there was no grassroots movement at all. And so I didn't really know what I was going to do. A friend that I met, because he had also been in Washington, he and I organized a couple of things that year, and they were small and felt very quixotic. But, again, it just didn't seem to be an option not to do something. And then he knew some other folks who wanted to start a 350 Seattle chapter, and so I joined in with them, and we did that. We were organizing still reasonably small protests. Some of them still felt completely quixotic. Some of them started to feel less so. And I kept writing. And time after time, I noticed that I would write another version of the same story. And that was, people are suffering. We are all at unimaginable risk. We must change now. And it felt weird because a year went by. And that is still the story that I'm writing. And that is the story that I'm telling at this moment to some degree, and it's always been true, and it is now beyond terrifyingly true. On April 5th, Carbon Brief released an analysis indicating that at current rates of emissions, we had only 4.1 years left if we wanted even a two-thirds chance of remaining below 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming, which was the goal of the Paris Agreement. And beyond that point, our systems start to fall apart and very frightening feedback loops kick in. So I don't know about you, but I would like more than a two-thirds chance of avoiding that. And to be clear, when they say 4.1 years, they don't mean, and then we have to get really serious about cutting our emissions. They mean, and then we have to stop entirely, 100%. I don't know about you, but I don't think we're going to be ready to do that in 4.1 years. And also, the thing is, 6 weeks have passed since that report came out. We now have less than 4 years. I mean, every day that passes, this gets harder. You may have seen the New York Times piece on Antarctica this week. Scientists believe that we may have already reached the point where the Antarctic ice sheet, that its collapse is unstoppable. And even if we were to stop using fossil fuels tomorrow, the Antarctic ice sheet is still going to keep melting, and that's going to add massive amounts of height to the ocean. The sea level rise will be incredible. The same piece mentioned, almost as an afterthought, that current modeling has the worst case sea level rise scenarios at double what they were predicting just 4 years ago. Or you may have also seen the Washington Post article in the last week that talked about the so-called, not silent springs, but quiet springs as a result of climate change, changing the migration and mating cycles that birds depend upon because their biology is triggered by the daylight and by the sun. And therefore, the warming is changing what's available for them to eat, but they're still migrating. So bird numbers, like all other species on this planet, are plummeting. If these stories feel like a barrage and they feel unbearable, I'm deeply sympathetic. That's exactly how they feel to me. But they're nothing like the barrage that the facts are going to be. And in our lifetimes, not in our children's lifetimes, not in our grandchildren's lifetimes, but in our lifetimes. And of course, worse for our children and grandchildren. So this is the moment that we have to act boldly on climate, because we're nearing a point where our window of opportunity to save some kind of a decent, humane future is going to disappear. And here we are, seemingly paralyzed by our politics and paralyzed by our culture. We seem to have moved in negative seconds from, this is something I don't have to think about yet, to, but it's too late. So what can we do? And I think the first and most important thing to dispel is this whole question of, it's too late. Because too late for what? And too late for whom? You know, there is a difference between some portions of the world becoming difficult to live in or even impossible to live in, and all of the world becoming difficult or impossible to live in. There is a difference between 10% biodiversity loss, which is a tragedy, and 95% biodiversity loss, which is a tragedy of just unimaginable proportions. And these differences are very much worth fighting for, and we will always have to be fighting for these differences. There is not a moment ever where we can say, well, wow, this is terrible, but it's happening and I can't do anything about it, because we can always do something about it. So we'll fight. And here in the Northwest, we have won several big, important battles, you know, against oil train spurs and coal terminals, against Arctic drilling, even against working with banks that fund projects like the Dakota Access Pipeline. We have taken projects that were absolutely business as usual, and we've stopped them cold. I'm very proud of this. I worked very hard in those fights, and I think they're an incredibly important part of our planet's immune system. Such projects at this moment are death, so we fight them. But it's important to admit that I didn't think we would win them. I fought because I knew deep in my bones that climate change is the defining moral issue of our era, probably of any era. And it's a problem that you and I help to cause every day of the week, while our brothers and sisters elsewhere suffer the effects. I wanted to do the right thing, so I fought. I organized people to go to hearings and protests. I created mailing lists. I sent a million emails and some petitions. I tried to understand each fight and its context so that I could write fact sheets and give testimony and talk to press as effectively as possible. I'm still an introvert, and none of this came naturally. I knew that my own voice was not enough, but that many voices had a chance. Or to be more honest, I thought we had to try. I didn't really think we had a chance. Winning came as a profound surprise. Against the enormity of climate change, what impact do these wins have? I could list many. By stopping terminals, we changed the economics of coal and helped to speed the transition to renewables. Thanks in part to us, there have been no oil spills in the fragile Arctic in the last year. And over the course of the next year or so, I believe that we can make the financing of these projects toxic to banks because they care about their reputations, and they actually don't have much in the way of their investments in these banks. So if we can make that portion of their portfolio toxic, we can keep banks from funding these projects, and we can make it much more difficult and expensive to build them, which means that fewer of them will get built. But the biggest impact, if we do things right, is that we understand our own power. Because it's not actually climate change we're fighting. Climate change is a natural response, like a person running a fever. What we're fighting is the agent of that fever, and that's fossil fuel use, which is widespread for sure, but it's a human artifact subject to social and political forces, by which I mean you and me. And once I understood that we really could do these things, when Shell announced the end of its Arctic drilling, something deep inside me shifted. What had been an overwhelming problem and a source of deep despair became, not instead, but also, something that I personally could have a meaningful impact on. Because I had found a community of people who believed in this work and were committed to trying. I had helped to build that community, in fact. Before, I had been acting from a sense of responsibility. I could no longer look myself in the mirror if I wasn't doing all I could to change these things. After, I was acting from a sense of agency. And I began to understand viscerally that to not act now, to whatever degree one is capable, is to give consent to what is happening now. which within decades, scientists have made clear, will amount to the end of the world as humans have known it since the dawn of civilization. The fossil fuel companies need our consent. They run millions of miles of pipelines through our farmland. They run thousands of tankers through our waters and hundreds of oil trains in our towns. If we don't let them, they can't destroy the world. Justin Trudeau, who will come to regret this fact, put it succinctly, governments can grant permits, but only communities can grant permission. How do we grant permission? By allowing business as usual to continue, even when we know that it is threatening everything and everyone that we love. How hard is it really to shut off a pipeline? How hard is it to go through the stress of a trial and maybe even go to jail? Not anything like as hard as living with a destabilized world is going to be, as it already is for hundreds of thousands of people displaced from their homes by flooding or drought. It's not even as hard as it would be for me to reach old age having seen terrible things and know that I had done little to try to stop them. Make no mistake, we can change the world. Again, it's not climate change we have to fight. It's just fossil fuel use and the people who insist we need it. I was one of a few dozen core people who put the final fistfuls of straw on the camel's back of Shell's Arctic drilling, building upon the work of others and requiring the love and skills and time of many others. But still, on a numbers basis alone, we were not impressive. And on a financial level, we had next to nothing. Yet we raised holy hell and Shell blanked. And then on October 11th, I was one of five people who shut down pipelines that represented 15% of US daily oil use. Five of us. Did we stop the burning of tar sands? Did we stop the US purchase of tar sands? Did we change the fact that there are tar sands in my gas tank right now? We did not. But direct action is about many things, and one of those things is the power of embodying what needs to happen. We need to imagine a world in which it stops not because we've burned fossil fuels right up until the moment of collapse, but because we woke up, saw that we had the power to change things, and set about changing them with all the focus of people who see a tsunami in the far distance. Metaphorically speaking, you have enough time to call your friends and family, and you might have enough time to pack a bag. You do not have enough time to sit on the porch and wait till you're really sure it's a problem before you start running. Less than 4 years at current rates of emissions. If in 2 years we manage to scale back 20% and then 20% again the year after that, we'll have a little more time. And if we can get to that place, it will be because we have managed to move from a specious debate to a real plan, which means that the energies of many of us will be freed up to focus on other things. Things like regenerative agriculture, things like city policies to model a fast-changing world focused explicitly on justice and openness to those in need, especially migrants from places on the bleeding edge of climate instability, like East Africa, Syria, Yemen, and Louisiana. We are the richest country in history, and the companies most responsible for this problem, companies that have known about it since the 60s, are the richest companies in history. The technology that we need exists, as does the money. If we cannot use the word reparations freely for this, what does that word exist for? If we cannot change our lives to make room for those whose lives are devastated, who are we? As the Antarctic ice sheet is showing us, there is a great deal of instability that is already baked into the climate system. But for a little while longer, we still have the chance for a beautiful world. A world in which we are honest about our responsibilities and our interdependence, and in which we set ourselves on a path back to climate stability. If we can bring the concentration of carbon in the atmosphere back down to 350 parts per million by the end of this century, then we can get there. If we can't, it may be thousands of years before the Earth comes back into balance. Have we forgotten how to be brave? Have we forgotten how to sacrifice? Normal politics has utterly failed us. We know that voting and petitions won't do it. So what will you do about that? What can you imagine doing, knowing that your family and everyone else's is on the line? Can you join an oil train blockade? Can you plan a lockdown in the governor's office to demand that he press Trudeau to revoke the Trans Mountain permit? Can you shut down a bank branch to demand that the bank no longer finance projects that we know are disastrous? Can you demand that Kirkland greatly improve its mass transit so that ambitiously reducing fossil fuel use within a year or two is actually possible for most people? If we can imagine climate change bringing mass disruption all over the world, but we can't imagine doing those things, then we don't have a problem of climate change. We have a failure of imagination and a failure of agency. We have to rise to this challenge. Can we have a future without fossil fuels? Yes, we can. We know, in fact, that is the only future that we have. Can we start it in the next few years? Sure we can. Other countries have already done so. The fossil fuel industry, again, cannot devastate this world without our consent. We have to stand up for all that is good and beautiful and consent instead to the still small voice inside us. We have to reclaim our moral imaginations. We must be, we will be, brave and resilient. We face a profoundly uncertain future, but all we really need for the road ahead is our moral compass and a deep and abiding love. I am asking you, I am begging you, to think about what that means to you and what you can do to rise to the challenge. My life, your life, and all the life around us, it's worth fighting for.